and welcome to the Crossbox Podcast for September of 2016. I'm your host, Jay.
And I'm his co-host, John.
Well, we've got a good show lined up for you today, including a special edition of The News.
That's right. Today, unlike normal, where we each have a minute, and while Jay frantically gets his timer, and we each talk about something of our choosing, what's going to happen today is that we are going to discuss the LCX continuing to be a giant steaming ball of fail.
LCS.
Yes, the LCS. Little crappy ships.
Yes.
The LCS.
Yes.
It's a steaming ball of fail.
So, rather than put 1 minute on the clock like I usually do, I'm going to put 2 minutes on while
That's
we,
right!
You know, because... rag on it. In a shorter format to the one that we've already ragged on.
That's right.
A longer one.
Because this is a September 2016 We're Right Awards for us. This is very special for us.
We need a little like ditty for that.
An award to put on the website.
Yeah.
A little like, you know.
We were right.
Gold cup kind of thing.
Maybe we'll see if we can get Dan like to whip it up for us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because this is, you know, basically all of the things we predicted are in fact going wrong with it.
All right. So let's...
Three, two, one, hit it.
Well, we were right.
We were right. Isn't it great?
It's shocking, really.
We had said that the LCS was undercrewed. We had said that it was massively overpriced.
Underarmed.
Very underarmed. Didn't we also say that it was complete bullshit that you'd be able to interchange modules?
I think we had mentioned that at some point, yes.
That wasn't going to work, especially when the modules weren't ready immediately?
Not ready immediately, and, you know, also just, like, these big things you had to move in and out and had to, like, train different crews to, you know, know, and then...
Swapping the crews
wasn't those crews, like, well, swapping parts of the crews.
Oh, right, swapping parts of the crews. Yeah, this isn't like... You could, because... And what's interesting, I think, is that all the little pieces of this ship could have been something. Like, the money is ridiculous for what you get.
Oh, yeah.
That amount of money is about the same as a Fridtjof Nansen.
Yes.
The wonderful Norwegian frigates. And there's, depending on how much you want to spend, if you want to spend a little more or a little less, there's corvettes and frigates and whatever names we want to call. But plenty of ships out there that can be excellent members of the fleet that are also smaller than an Arleigh Burke.
Bisbees, if you want to go like corvette size, which is about what you're getting in terms of armament out of the LCS, except with less anti-ship capability.
Right, somehow. also, you're getting quite a lot of ship with the LCS. Like, there's a lot of physical hull and things to go wrong.
Yes, and that's expensive.
Yes.
And when it does go wrong, there aren't enough people on board to fix it. Which
right?
is, again, another thing that we said.
Yep, because, you know, crews are important. And I think the other thing I should point out is that there is a Navy, at least the Danes, have done some amount of swappable
modularity
things.
Yeah, as I recall.
But they designed the ship to be, you could swap it with, you know, a pretty simple crane.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the modules end up being semi-permanent, which is what the Danes found. And then the ship also doesn't have any kind of crews that move.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the whole crew moving thing, I think, is the worst part of it all. Because you can't really expect, you know, a commander to trust these new anti-submarine guys who come on with the sonar module. And
right.
It's just, it makes no sense.
Nope.
It's a terrible ship. We were right. And we will take our reward thusly.
Yep. Take that, Navy.
There you go.
Oh, we're out of time. Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, good thing we established that we were right.
Yes. Right indeed.
All right. So, the gun post is also going to be a little different today for a whole bunch of reasons. Jay has a really long discussion because, like a weirdo, and I'm going to come back to this later, but like a weirdo, he decided that to forget about any kind of kit that might be remotely competitive for time in the sport of two-gun, and instead he would take...
Oh, see, I want to come back to that later.
Remotely competitive for time in the sport of two-gun, and he took a 303 Lee Enfield and a Webley Mark IV revolver in 38.
Yes.
However, fortunately for him, the stages were much shorter than we might normally expect.
Well, I don't know. I don't think they really were in terms of tracking. But we'll come back to that later.
Yes.
I've got this whole thing planned out.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, see, look at him planning.
If you'll look on the screen here, I've got all these notes. Those things that John never takes and things that I need to not babble on like an idiot.
Right.
Forever. Not to say that I'm not going to anyway. But...
Oh, boy. So brace yourselves, folks. You're in for the duration.
This could be a long one.
So, Jay, tell us about the kit that you selected,
the whole everything.
Whole enchilada.
I carried what I've been calling the Brit kit. It is a smelly, a short magazine Lee Enfield rifle, a number one Mark III in the later parlance, which is the World War I pattern Lee Enfield. Mine's actually a number one Mark III star, which means they modified it slightly to make it a little bit easier to produce, given that it was, you know, in the middle of the...
You needed rifles.
In the middle of the Great War.
And
needed
not magazine
cuffs. A lot of rifles, yeah. magazine cutoffs or the volley sights.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Volley sights are useless. News at 11. We were right again.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, that I feel like between the volley sights and the bayonet, the one used more often is, like, overwhelmingly going to be the bayonet.
Yes. Yeah,
at the trench ranges. The whole, like, we're going to shoot those guys at 2,000 yards with their rifles proved to be hopelessly optimistic.
Yep.
Anyway, so although the improved number 4 Mark I, which John here has one of, and it's you know, the same rifle mechanically, but it's got much nicer sights. Well, that was the official rifle of the Second World War. The Smellies from World War I stocks found their way into use too, just because it was, again, you needed a lot of rifles, and you have all these ones that, you know, they did pretty well back in the day.
And it's functioning the same rifle and uses the same ammo, which is very important.
That is very important. So it is the defining feature of the Lee Enfield is its action. The Enfield action, which, unlike every other military bolt-action rifle of which I am aware, well, any other, like, traditional one with, you know, the four stage thing as opposed to the straight pulse, which had their own problems, as the Canadians discovered. The defining feature is the bolt, which, rather than cocking when you open the bolt, cocks when you're pushing it forward, which is nice because it puts no torque on the rifle to do the cocking, which is usually the hardest step, the biggest spring to work against. And since there is no torque, that means you stay on target very well when you're moving the bolt, and it's very fast to work. The handle is also well placed. It's right above the trigger, so your hand drops naturally right back down to where it ought to be.
So what he's telling you is that, in fact, despite being a World War I rifle, as far as bolt-action service rifles go, this is also a horrible gamer rifle.
Yes, really, really it is.
had gun games in 1914.
Let's explain the second reason why. It's also got a 10-round magazine, unlike...
10 rounds! That's blasphemous! That's borderline offensive to liberals!
That's pretty much in the it's the unlimited class of its day.
Right, right, exactly. Most other nations had 5 or 6, or 3 in the case of the LaBelle.
Yeah. Well, he had that really weird cartridge to work with.
Yep.
Yeah. And no, like, protrusions beneath the thing. Anyway, so besides that, you have your standard notch and post sights with the tangent, with the hopelessly optimistic tangent out to 2,000 yards.
Mm-hmm.
That's about that. It's an excellent rifle for reasons I'll get into later. My second arm was the Webley M38. As John said, that's the British issue sidearm of the Second World War. In between the World Wars, they decided that 455 was, for some reason, you know, too big, despite the fact that it had acquired a great reputation as a man-stopper, and they'd already had, you know, a bunch of the cartridges and a bunch of the revolvers. Again, the 455s found their way into use, and had I had my choice, I would have shot my 455. But ammunition is basically impossible to find, and it would have been significantly more expensive than my rifle ammo had I been able to find it.
Yep. So, we did find some of that gun show.
We did. Yeah.
That was amazing. Those were hen's teeth.
The other thing about it is it's very hard to find speed loaders, which I did not use, but I might next time, for reasons, again, I'll get into at the end of this. My example of the 38 Webley is not... Well, it's a rig-action revolver, obviously, as all Webleys are, with the lovely automatic ejection that sprays the empties everywhere when you pop it open. Fun fact, they're about the same size as 9mm brass, except with a rim, so... unwary reloaders might accidentally gather some up by accident and then, you know, put it into the dies and be like, wait, why is this not working? My example, like I said, was not a wartime model, but it was built for the Singapore Police Force in the 1960s, which is super fun. You know, your classic colonial thing. May have blasted some unruly locals at some point in its history.
It also probably means that you'd have less wear on your copy as opposed to an actual war bringback.
Well, I mean, my 455 is a war bringback, and that's basically pristine.
Oh.
And
actually, interesting, this is the one with the timing issues, isn't it?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
All right, well, maybe I take that back.
Well, it may have been used more. I mean, the officer's sidearm is not, like, a super commonly drawn thing. Whereas, in Singapore, I feel like the police revolver is something used basically every day.
And plus, you know, again, having the 38-455 thing, it may have, previous owners to you may have ended up using it.
That's true. Yeah, same deal. Because you can actually find 38 Smith & Wesson ammunition for, you know, roughly 45 prices. Which, in terms of power factor per unit price, is not doing very well. But in terms of I can shoot this at competitions, is great.
That's actually function. That's actually workable.
Yeah.
Fun fact: Indy, as in Indiana Jones, not Indy Nidell, uses 455 Webleys quite often because, of course, Lucas, being a cheapskate and having no money, filmed a lot in England, and those were around at the time. Also, the 455 Webley cartridge is one of 3 pistol cartridges listed by the Colonel Jeff Cooper as acceptable man-stoppers. The 455 in that regard is joined by the 45 ACP and the 10mm Auto, both of which are going to be much more well-known to our listeners.
Yes. So if I could find, like I said, if I could find the 455 ammo for a reasonable price, I think I would shoot it next time. But alas, I cannot.
Right.
Anyway, the strangest feature of this of my 38 Webley is that it has a factory safety, something I presume was required by the police specification. It's a little like hammer block thing that you push over to one side to let the hammer move back. It's got unusual sights, like all Webleys. Rather than a notch end post or a V end post, it has like a notched V end post.
So yeah, it's kind of goofy.
You have the top of the rear sight, which then turns down diagonally to the base of it, like to a flat base, which is again like a lowered notch for the notch and post.
Yeah.
Thing. And I believe the correct sight picture is you're supposed to hold so that the top of the front sight is level with the top of the outer part of the rear sight. So you're like kind of holding above a V, which is unnatural and very hard to do reliably.
Not quick.
No, it's not.
Nor
is it especially accurate.
No. Though, I mean, it was like the 15-yard steal at the range redo. Like, that was the sight picture I had when I was shooting at those.
And
that seemed to work okay. So, again, you know, my skill, and any inaccuracies of the pistol.
Now, see, I did find that I had to hold low and to the right. The front sight on this particular revolver is bent to the left somewhat. So hitting to the right would be expected if that's not by design, but I'm still not convinced that it's not me. So the next time I'm at the range, I'm going to want to put it on the bench some and...
We might also trade off a bit to see if we can duplicate it.
Yeah.
Just let me cut in here. For our listeners, if you do encounter weird things like the pistol is shooting oddly, it's often a good idea to get your friends to try it and to try to confirm it. And often, you know, better still, if you know someone who shoots significantly better than you do, have this person try to confirm it. Because this is a good way to, you know, make sure that you don't have, you know, it's not just you. Often, you know, we would often expect, though again, older guns might be a little different, but we'd often expect that most shooting errors are going to be the yabo behind the trigger.
Especially most pistol shooting errors.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. You know, the famous left shooting Glock. Mm. Then the guy drifts his sight to the right, and then he, you know, sets it, comes back to it, and he's like, wait, why is it shooting so off?
That happened to a guy at the match, in fact.
Yeah, you know.
Well, it may actually have been shooting off.
Yeah, but, well, that's one of those, it's hard to determine.
You need to give a friend the gun.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Give a friend, take your time, use a bench. This is one of the few times that I actually like benches.
Oh, yeah, for verifying accuracy.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, take your time with it, and that's another good time to do that slow fire kind of bullseye type technique. Anyway, let's talk about that kit you had on.
Well, it's the British Pattern 1937 webbing, and my notes say I'm going to go into that later, so I'm going to trust my notes.
All right, never mind.
Anyway, quick reminder about the rules. The match rules were standard two-gun rules, so if you go to, you know, 3gunnation.com and read their rules, deleting every paragraph about shotguns, you have what we were doing.
Yep.
This particular rule set seems to prioritize speed a little bit. Your aim is to hit the paper twice if you're using wimpy small guns, or once if you're using proper large full power rifles like me. That's basically it.
Yeah.
There are steel targets you knock down with a pistol, and paper targets you hit with a rifle.
And then the other thing I do want to bring up, so we're in Western Pennsylvania. Which means that unlike some other people who we will not name, we don't have giant, long sight lines. So again, the targets are generally close to us, relatively speaking. And that might also prioritize speed over slow marksmanship a bit.
Just the longest bay at that range is 60 yards.
Right.
Or 60 to 80 yards or so.
Yeah, give or take. So, and that's not really, in this case, we'll talk more about this later. But again, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, we're totally in agreement that there's nothing wrong with the like the run and gun style. It's just a different style to the one that perhaps this kit would be best at. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as far as my equipment rules went, I decided to to set myself a few challenges. So I've got this under the heading the Royal King's Light Royal British Infantry King's Guard rules. The first rule: you should try and use contemporaneous firearms if possible. So if you want to use, say, a Krag and an Astra 900, that's okay because they were both around at least. Firearms in the same pattern both around at the same time and in use at the same time.
Right.
Whereas if you wanted to use your Kar 98 and your Glock, that's a little bit more questionable.
Yeah. Well, depending on the Glock. Oh, yeah.
If you can't do contemporaneous firearms because not everybody is a collector of historical stuff like me.
Right.
You should at least try and approximate the limitations of the time. So if you take your Enfield out, also take a revolver. If you take your Mauser, I'll probably get away with a single stack Glock because not only you're giving up capacity there, you're also giving up, you know, easy shooting this for a bigger gun.
The single stack Glocks are all tiny.
Now, if you wanted to take your Garand and your 2011, I'd probably say no, because right. that's, you know,
yep.
not the right
thing. The other thing in this vein, one thing talking to Jay, because I was considering doing this as well at some point in the future, is I want to take my Garand out, and depending on 1911 availability and my buying habits, I might take out my fancy 1911, which is technically a 1911, same pattern. But of course, it's, you know,
it's a much nicer.
It's a really, really nice one. And the one thing I would do is I would say, well, I'm going to use my Wilson Combat magazines because those are the most reliable magazines I've found for that 1911. Mm. But I would only load 7 rounds of my magazines. So I'm not really willing to give up, like, or to change magazines and, you know, go with some cheap, crappy USGI knockoff gun store junk. But I'm still trying to replicate the limitations of you got 7, you can shoot 7 Nazis,
then you
have to reload.
Yeah. It's only better than a pistol in terms of like speed and the one extra.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Better than a revolver.
Revolver. Yeah. Well, it also fires the 45 ACP round, and we know that causes people to explode.
Oh yeah. Just like in the movies.
Exactly. And they get thrown back.
Even in, you know, ball.
Exactly. Oh yeah, they all fall to hard ball, my friend.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So the next two rules are maybe slightly more optional. Things from the same country are preferred.
Right.
I mean, it may be like a slight time penalty if you're scoring yourself against somebody else who's shooting the same rules, but not like that big of one, because the aim is to take the historical stuff that you have and to shoot it in a competition setting to see how good it is, or, you know, the difficulties you might have faced using it back in the day.
Right.
The other one in the same thing is to wear period-appropriate load-carrying gear. Your Molly thing with all the fancy attachable pouches is, you know, super handy to set up for the way you want it exactly, but that's not how they did it back in the day.
Right.
The webbing, as I'm going to get into later, had pouches in two particular places, and you got to use those pouches, pretty much.
You're stuck with it.
Yeah. Maybe bonus points for, you know, using webbing from the country you're presenting, but, I mean, I'm not going to be a stickler about that, because I can say if I wanted to, like, borrow John's Garand for a day, and, like, a 1911 and shoot those, and I didn't want to spend, say, $200 on American webbing, I'm already going to be spending like that much on, say, rifle ammunition.
Yeah.
You know, for 30-06. I'm going to call it okay. The British kit will be fine. It's the same kind of idea.
You're trying to get the
limitations of the day.
Yeah, contemporaneous kind of stuff, you know, even if it's not perfect.
The final and most important rule is that you carry everything. You don't get to bring a range bag. Everything you need for the match gets to go in your web gear somewhere. That's your magazines, chargers, or clips, depending on your firearm. All the ammunition you're going to need, including any extra you want to bring in case you shoot more than you think you're going to.
Yep.
Your tools, your snacks, your water, your sunscreen, your hat, your ear protection, your eye protection if it's separate, everything goes in the webbing, no range bag.
Yep.
Which, again, I'll get into the results of that later, but it proved very interesting as far as, you know, the soreness of my legs went the next day.
Even so, for Jay, the runner.
Yeah.
No, the former runner.
Different things. Different requirements. Anyway, getting into the webbing, as I mentioned before, it's the British issue webbing of the Second World War, the pattern of 1937. The stuff I was wearing is more like 1942 or 1943, because of the pouches, which I'll mention in a second. So the basis of the kit is a belt, basic pouches, and suspenders, or braces, if you happen to be English.
But we're not.
We're not. I have them written down as braces because, you know, that's what they are.
I guess the kit. But you know, suspenders to people who live in a country that put the man on the moon.
Yes. Probably by people wearing suspenders, in fact. I bet they played a big role. So, you know, you start with the belt. It's kind of a standard web belt in like the 1.5 or 2 inch width.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like a hefty web belt because it got a hold of a bunch of stuff. Things attach by means of C-hooks, which loop over the belt and mate with pouches on the inside of the belt. So you start
pockets. Yeah.
You start with the belt. You put the basic pouches in the front. The basic pouches are these big, like, I don't know, 6 or 8 inch tall, 3 inch deep pouches. They're big enough to hold 3 Bren magazines, so that gives you an idea of the size. I put 50 rounds of rifle ammunition in chargers in one of them, that about filled it up halfway. So there's a lot of space.
Yeah. It'd be interesting, actually. I would like to try it with, like, see what I can do with AR-15 magazines. That might be a more useful unit of measure, since our listeners aren't Bren gunners.
If only I'd brought one up with me. anyway, so you got that. The suspenders / braces go through the top of the basic pouches to hold them to your chest, and then cross on your back and mate with the back of the belt. The suspenders are also extra long, so you can the end hang below belt level, and you hang things on the brace ends, as your pattern 37 webbing site of choice will tell you when you're trying to assemble it. Now, not being a British soldier of the Second World War, I was issued both a rifle and a pistol, because this is a two-gun competition, and as far as I know, there aren't any rules in Three Gun Nation about bayoneting pistol targets.
Yeah, unfortunately.
If there were, I totally would have done that.
It would have been funny.
Ah!
Clunk.
So yeah, I wore the pistol case, as the British say, on my right side, and the pistol ammo pouch on the left. Now, I had room on my belt, just because I wasn't wearing the bayonet frog or the other stuff that goes on the...
entrenching tool.
Yeah, the entrenching tool. The other stuff you might want to have beneath the belt. Now, the holster is a cross-draw holster, but that's not really compatible with range safety rules, such as don't point your gun at people behind you.
Yeah, you're going to, like, break the 180, like
instantly.
And often.
Yeah.
180 so, violation, 180 violation, 180 violation. Muzzle again.
Well, it'd be, you know, match DQ.
Well, no, there might be a warning in there. Like, if he's really nice to you.
You should switch the side of your holster. Yeah, so I wore it on the strong side, but the ammo pouch on the weak side. Yeah. The ammo pouch was rated for a box holding 12 rounds of munition, but without trouble, I put 30 loose ones in and was able to close the snap. So
good enough.
I wore the British canteen, which is a tin one with a cork one, and a tin canteen with a cork stopper. And the I kind of prefer a rubber stopper, since the cork one seems like kind of a mold risk. But I guess that wasn't really very important when you're being shot at by Nazis. So
yeah, you know, it's, if you live long enough to be affected by the mold, then good on you, sir.
So I wore the canteen on the brace ends on my right side. And there was also a haversack, you know, a little pack thing. It's kind of like satchel size. It's over there. I brought the microphone up to our recording studio, air quotes, in said satchel / haversack.
It's a good size.
Yeah, you can wear it on the brace ends. And I was going to do that at first, but I realized you can't really load it too heavily when doing so, just because of the way it has to kind of contour to your leg. So I decided to wear it on my back instead. And, you know, that was closer to the original battle order anyway.
I do want to bring up here.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in conjunction with your rules, and also a chance to give you a chance to sip that water. You're not quite doing, so while you're using more or less period correct equipment, setting aside, you know, pedantic nonsense like, well, nobody carried a Lee Enfield rifle and a Webley pistol. Shut up. We'll bayonet that guy.
We do have a, maybe not for today, but we do have a topic on that note coming up for you. So stay tuned.
Yep. But I do want to say that you're not, so while you're using, you know, appropriate roughly period kit with your roughly appropriate period rifles, these, you know, to mating up with, you know, the requirements of the competition, you're not quite doing a complete British soldier's kit here.
Right. I'm missing the entrenching tool, which in my defense was often left behind because it turned out to be much worse than, you know, tossing two picks and a bunch of shovels in the truck.
Right.
Or I also wasn't carrying I wasn't carrying
the bayonet.
Any of the stuff that would ordinarily go in the haversack.
Right, you know, like clothing, spare uniforms, shaving kit, some bully beef.
Yeah, exactly.
And like a tin. Yeah, and that's okay, because again, the point of this isn't to run the two-gun match with a British soldier's loadout. It's to see how certain older elements of historical gunfighting how have these things aged is kind of how we're going.
Exactly.
Like playing an old game, relevant later.
Yes.
And again, I want to come back to this point, but I wanted to bring it up now to set things up. But go on. So, your kit.
It turned out that I had enough room in the pouches, since they're gigantic, to carry everything I wanted at hand during a stage. That was in the right pouch, I had my spare rifle ammo, which I didn't have to dip into very much, because 10 rounds is a good amount, as we'll come to in a little bit. And in the right pouch, I had a spare box of ammo for each caliber, so I could refill after a stage without having to take the haversack off of my back. The load distribution, I thought, was actually very good for gear of its age. I wasn't carrying all that much, like 30 pounds tops when I was carrying the rifle. But that said, it didn't even begin to hurt my shoulders. I basically couldn't even tell I had the extra weight on me unless I was like bent over really awkwardly, as you often are when you're setting up steel targets after a stage has been run.
Yep.
But yeah, it was basically as though the load wasn't there, which is, you know, your aim when you're working with load carrying gear. On that note, I do have newfound respect for people who schlep stuff for a living, especially the infantry. I mean, I already had a good deal of respect for them beforehand.
Yeah.
But, like, a half day of moving and shooting made my legs ache carrying, like, that 20 or 30 pounds of extra stuff. And that's, like, a third of what you might carry on a light day
right.
in the stand.
Right, yeah, in the stand when you set your pack down.
Yeah.
And actually, I do kind of want to, like, revisit this again later, except I want to do it with more modern weapons because I prefer those.
Yeah.
And body armor, because that's a nice handicap for the guy with the race AR, is, you know, rifle plates. But anyway, let's talk about how. So how'd you do?
Well, I've got results. Well, I had two goals first. I wanted to not time out of any stages.
That's good.
At performance shooting sports, you have 180 seconds for each stage, and I'm proud to say that I did not time out of any stages.
Excellent. Actually, can I just interject briefly?
Please.
This is something I really like about the performance shooting sports stages. And part of this, of course, is based on level of interest and stage design. But I really like that the part-time, and again, part-time, you know, if you go over part-time, it's not like golf. When you hit part-time, you're done. You stop. And I think that it's really nice to be able to have a part-time that's set up so that unless you have a really bad malfunction or you're really awful that day, you should be able to at least engage every target on the range.
Exactly, yeah.
And again, that's important. We drive, what, about an hour and a half?
Yeah.
We drive about an hour and a half this match each way.
Yeah, if I'm getting cut off midway through the stage, that's like kind of a waste of my money.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What the hell did I come out here for?
Yeah.
And again, so I've seen this in certain other matches that, you know, often I really want to see that the stage should be done so that most shooters can complete it in the part-time listed.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the time. And anything else is really, why am I going to your match?
Yeah.
I want to shoot the match, not get yelled at. If I want to get yelled at, well, I'd make a joke with my wife, but I'm unmarried. But first off, I have a wife. And then I just stay at home and let her yell at me.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I finished on time. I was within 38 seconds in the last stage, only because of a flubbed rifle reload. The stretch goal I had was to beat somebody else's time. So then everyone else, of course, using, you know, modern rifles. There was somebody there with somebody else with an AK. I saw them. They were finishing up a stage before we were like our group, before our squad shot it.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but next time we're there, if he has one, I'd like to say hello and, you know,
compare notes.
He's brotherhood of AK shooters, duh.
Exactly. Now it'd be interesting to compare notes because there's not a lot of, you know, AK competition AK shooters for. Yeah. Pretty much obvious reasons.
It's not like a super ergonomic gun. Anyway, so I confess I did not actually beat anybody, but if I'd found another 10 seconds, I would have been in position 27 out of 28, maybe like, I think, 13 seconds. So
yeah.
I'll be completely honest, but if I had reloaded a little bit faster or shot a little bit faster at various stages, I could have totally done it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's surprisingly competitive. Again, for, you know, a revolver that you... And again, remember, this is a revolver that you have to load one round at a time, because he wasn't loaded using speed loaders, though he might.
Yes, we'll come back to that. The thingy.
The Lee Enfield.
Yes, well, the Lee Enfield. There's one more thing I had about results. Oh, yeah, the Lee Enfield, it turns out, was actually competitive for rifle times, because of a quirk of the stage design, mostly. The stages were all 10 rifle targets, and I had to engage each of them once. And with a 25-inch barrel and targets set between, like, you know, 3 and 20 yards, that's basically reaching out and, like, putting the muzzle on the target.
Yeah, that's you're in point shooting range
It's pretty much cheating. Actually, I did point shoot. There was one, on one stage, you had to shoot around a barricade offhanded.
Mm-hmm.
So I... You know, leaned around the barricade with the target about 4 yards away.
Yeah.
Kind of guessed and saw a little hole appeared like dead center in the target. Yeah.
Perfect, which is what you should do at close range.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're pressed for time. Good choice.
Yep. So yeah, the Lee Enfield, I've always had the suspicion, and there's a post we've been percolating for far too long, that it's the finest bolt-action military rifle ever devised. And I think that's probably true. As a pure implement of battle.
Yeah.
It's more than accurate enough. I had fast hits on those, what, like 6 or 8 inch plates at 70 yards and was dead center on most of the paper targets, like I mentioned. The bolt is very, very fast. Like people, like the point where people remarked on it at the match. Like, well, I don't think I'd work that bolt that fast. But no, you probably could. It's not that hard.
It's not that hard. But again, we're pretty casual guys, especially Jay's much more casual about his shooting than me. I get neurotic about these things. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not sitting there, you know, in his underwear, you know, working the bolt for hours and hours every day.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oiling it with modern lube. getting it Cerakoted.
And well, see, the thing is, and it seemed like I was. It's just, it's that fast of an action. It's that easy to shoot quickly. There were plenty of times when, as I was transitioning between targets, I would be done working the bolt before I finished swinging the rifle from a target, say, maybe, what, 10 degrees to one side.
Yeah.
And that's fast.
Yep.
That's, like, basically as fast. Well, it's not appreciably slower than a semi-auto for that kind.
Right, exactly. That's good enough to keep them competitive with speed. And again, it's, you know, because of that quirk. So the things that would get you, so the quick follow-ups wasn't really, like, quick follow-up, not really an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And
even if it was, I could have, like, I wouldn't have been that slow.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, you know.
Well, certainly, I think, I've got a good comparison here because the first time I shot, I took out my my AK, which has a fixed 4-power sight on it.
Yeah.
And that, of course, will also slow down your follow-ups on super close targets. And I would say that had I had to make a second shot on most of them, like I would have been about as fast with the Lee Enfield as I was with the AK on targets where, you know, your field of vision is filled with brown, as you can see the target.
Right. No, that's pretty good. And again, the other thing that wasn't coming to play for you in general was the reloads.
Yes.
Because you're going to be slower than a guy with an AR. Mm. You just are. And he also has to reload less often than you, even if he's double tapping.
Yeah.
But again, with fewer rifle targets, that wasn't a big problem. So kudos to the Lee Enfield and the Designer's Enfield for really the last good thing they ever made.
A soft shooting rifle. It's a lighter cartridge than your 30-06 or your Mauser. It's lighter even, I think, than 7.62 NATO. It's like, what, 170 grains at 2,500 feet per second. So it's, like, again, a fairly light cartridge.
And I think the Lee Enfield is a little bit heavier than a Mauser.
Yeah, it's like, what, probably 9.5 pounds loaded.
Right. Which is
like eight and some empty.
You're closing in on Garand's weight.
Yeah. So yeah, the sights are meh, obviously, but they fixed that later on. And like we were saying, I'm pretty sure it's the cream of the crop from 1907 when this mark came into play. Through the introduction of the Garand.
Yep.
Thoughts on the Webley? I guess it's a military revolver. It's kind of what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of speed loaders really hurt. Like I said, since my rifle times were vaguely competitive, just because of the number of targets, the engagement requirements, I would have been I was close when there were heavy rifle stations. I didn't have to worry about pistol reloads. When I did have to worry about reloading the revolver, I was much, much slower, because again, going one by one is not a fast way to do things.
Right.
So in both wars, there did exist speed loaders for revolvers of those calibers. They just weren't generally issued. But officers would frequently, you know, go and
buy them.
Yeah, look through the mail order catalog and say, I'd like three of these Prado devices. And So as I said, the sights were off, but the revolver was pretty accurate. Otherwise, I had no trouble hitting sadistic 3-inch steel circle targets at maybe 5 to 7 yards, or a 3 by 6 inch steel plate at like 10 or 12. That single action trigger is, you know, nice. It's an extremely clean break, as you'd expect out of a revolver.
It's good.
Mine needs a new pawl, but it still shoots fine, even the lockup's not quite as tight as it could be.
Shot the single action trigger again. Yeah. I would agree. It's a solid one.
Yes,
it's not quite Smith & Wesson revolver good, but it's
decent. Well, it was built. Well, it was designed in, like, you know, the late
1800s. Yeah, so exactly.
They've got a little bit of
older system. Smith & Wesson does a lot.
There are some really weird bits about the action, which I see we've already gone for 30 minutes, so I'm not going to go into them now. But maybe at a later date.
Yep. And I want to just briefly revisit something we were touching on, which is that this is kind of a fun challenge that Jay wanted to do, because Jay loves historical rifles. And it's wonderful fun to try to see how do these stack up. But in poker on the internet, we found some other people out there who maybe aren't as happy with the way certain things have progressed technology-wise.
We're talking about...
Yes, yeah, okay. Them.
Well, I want to jump in to John's in jumping before we go any further and say that the stage design at performance shooting sports is fun, I would say, in a lot of places, but it's not altogether what I'm looking for as like a rifle marksmanship challenge, which again, it's not really designed to be a rifle marksmanship challenge. It's a run and gun competition.
Right. And also there's other technological limitations, physical limitations
to what they can do there.
Right. So even if you had a guy come in and say, I really want to make this rifle marksmanship, you'd be hard-pressed with limited range space.
Not much you can do,
I mean, you can make small targets, but that's really penalizing guys with less than perfect.
So that's one thing these people were about to talk about, we're trying to fix, and I think John will talk about it.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm okay with playing around with stage design and trying to make it, I hate this term, but I'm going to have to use it, more realistic. And realistic's in air quotes, folks. Because remember,
I think we can tell.
This is a game. And at the end of the day, there's a number of things that you fundamentally can't recreate from combat. Match stress is always going to be less than combat stress, because targets here, we had steel targets and we had cardboard targets. Neither of those move under their own power or shoot back.
Yes, that latter one is the most important.
They don't shoot back at you. And you know, there's no real good way to do that. Now, some of you may think, oh, but what about simmunitions? Well, most people don't own those. So you'd have all of like 5 people at the match who could participate. Do you trust those 5 people with simmunitions guns? And then you also need a shoot house, because you have to be coming at each other. So the standard bay design is wrong. You have to find a shoot house. Very expensive. You're going to need some serious reps. You're probably going to need armor. And you only need one person to screw up, you know, taking the wrong Glock.
Yeah.
And then we also couldn't have any of this stuff, because you'd be using really simple like Glocks and like M4 build ARs. And that'd be
I couldn't. They don't make submunitions in 303 British.
Right. So, you know, stage design, a lot of it, I think you have to remember this is a game. and suck it up, Buttercup. Deal with it, right? This is not combat. We're not pretending it is, but it's a lot of fun, and it gives you some stress.
Yeah, some stress and like moving and shooting, which is something you don't practice enough.
At least most ranges.
You, listener, you don't practice enough.
Right. And again, you know, match stress is more than you get on a square range just sitting in a bay plinking away. Or even if your range lets you move, you don't get match stress like you do here with other people competing with you. That's good. Not as good as it's combat stress, but this way it's also a lot safer.
Yeah.
The other thing about these other people that I didn't like, and actually, interestingly, Jay agreed with me on this. They were seemingly fighting back against the tide of progress. So your rifle had to have no compensator. And the sport was like, you know, you must use iron-sighted rifles only. And there was a division in three-gun, a factory division rifle, can have a red dot. Or iron sights, as you prefer. I know Jay was using iron sights. Yeah. But if you were using an AR or an AK or something of that nature, if you could mount a red dot, you would.
I mean, I could have mounted a red dot on Lee Enfield somehow, but I feel like that would have been against the spirit of the challenge.
Right, and also, like, that's kind of... I don't want to drill the receiver for it. It's like a five-on match. Yeah, there you go. But no one in any army worth talking about uses iron sights. Like, every professional military that actually has a reasonable defense budget and isn't some third-world Kerplakistan place uses at least a red dot. The friggin' Russians use red dot sights on their Kalashnikovs. They honestly look like something other than Russian brands instead of, you know, the Aimpoint and EOTech we know here and Midwest Industries. But they look like something right out of the AK forum of, like, M4Carbine.net or ARFCOM. It's just, you got the rail handguard, you got the red dot on it. Is good rifle. It's just better.
Yeah.
And it really bothers me to have somebody say, no, you can't do that. Or you're going to be over there with the guy's magnification.
Yeah, that's it's against the spirit of the...
Right. No, it's not. Progress is very important. This is something we see all the time as we see the competition guys work something out. And then they'll pressure test something. And then the military guys start to pressure test it further.
In real pressure.
Because again, the competition guys, you know, on the one hand, you don't want your stuff to break.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you can leave it in a padded case and clean it a lot.
And you can, you know, baby it some.
Right,
like
exactly.
You probably won't see, say, your 2011 on the head of like a, you know, your special forces guy.
Right, probably not. It's, you know, the mags are a little touchy. Yeah. And now it's not horrible, but it's definitely something that you need to be aware of. And for a match shooter, getting a 1911 trigger with a giant box magazine, hell yeah, it's worth it to have a little bit of a touchy magazine. For, you know, a combat shooter, less of an issue. He's probably going to go Glock. But that's okay. And stuff like that, you know, the rule that said until they recently changed no compensators. You know, what the hell is that?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, see, the reason I'm against it is because they're, like, they do solve the complaint that I had where the stages are too gamey, if you're going to, like, make me use that word.
Yeah. Well, again, in air quotes, folks.
Yeah. But they took it, they take that concept way too far because I don't want to shoot, like, straight out of the 1980s.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the early 1980s Cold War era.
Right. Like you don't want to grab, like, an M16A2 and, like, a box stock AK-47.
I'd want to go older or newer.
Right? It's they're not really, like, that era is not really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't...
It's not as much, yeah.
It's like, you know, the age. You have to have a certain... And it's a different age for guns, but, you know, classic cars. It has to be 25 years old to be a classic, right? And, well, there's a different thing here, and these aren't classic weapons yet. Vietnam rifles, maybe. But, you know, like the M16A2, yawn. And so much of that is things... There's a post on this coming of a bigger rant about the M16A2. But so much of the M16A2 is just, why? Why is this here? It's stupid. You have a length of pull that I think was designed for Shaquille O'Neal and nobody else. You know, and like that stupid little nub on the grip that took an okay grip and made it crap. So, you know, it's... We're not... What I want to point out here is that Jay, my friend Jay here, is not trying to turn back the clock. He's trying to see... He's trying to bring something forward. See, how is this... It's like playing an old game.
Exactly.
Or watching an old movie. How is this lived up? You know, what does it do well? What doesn't it? And, you know, we were shocked at a lot of the conclusions we got. And that's what's fun about this.
Exactly.
We're trying to have fun. And we really probably wouldn't make a bunch of people do this.
Yeah. I mean, if they want to come out and compete with your World War II stuff, I would be more than happy. But
right.
I'm not going to complain if you're showing up with your, you know, your... Competition AR-15.
And that's why you have divisions.
Yeah.
And why we have this little challenge and why, you know, it's just, it's a mindset thing. And progress is good, folks.
Progress is good. I think that about covers it.
We're good.
Yeah.
We'll call that a good one. We'll wrap. That was a nice long one, but that's okay. Maybe this will be a longer podcast.
Yeah. Well, do you want to hop on games?
Sure thing. So games, speaking of bringing an old game forward. Yeah, I was setting the scene.
There's been some foreshadowing for that.
Yeah, exactly. And for good reason. So recently I've discovered on the internet, though again, this has been around for a while, GoldenEye Source. And the idea here is to take the Source engine, which itself is kind of venerable and in need of, well, a lot more love from Valve, but it's a thing.
Half-Life 3 confirmed.
That'll be the day. And it takes basically a total conversion mod to recreate a lot of the fun that was GoldenEye 007 on the original N64, which was the first multiplayer shooter on a console. Very revolutionary. Now, it had a lot of weird quirks, and the graphics were meh. But so this game, it brings the graphics back up to Source standards, which, again, not great. This is not the Unreal Engine. This isn't Doom 2016, but they are solid, good graphics. They redid a lot of the textures with a lot of love, and I'll get more to that in a second. And they also, you know, I'm on a PC, yeah, for the PC Master Race, mouse and keyboard. And the controls are mouse and keyboard, standard WASD, works great. There are some of the quirks that they kept.
Let me jump on controls real quick. I was playing something with somebody last night, and over the course of the conversation, it turned to Halo 5 for PC, which is Halo 5 Forger, they're calling it. And I said that it seems like it's interesting, but I feel like it kind of doesn't get at the nugget of Halo-ness, because I feel like if I could turn, you know, basically instantly, you can with mouse and keyboard,
yeah,
I'd lose something from, you know, the ponderous sort of, I'm turning with a controller.
Yeah, and actually I think in this case it really helps, because GoldenEye was still in that 90s school of really twitchy shooters, and putting a keyboard and mouse in your hands just makes it twitchier.
It's natural, yeah.
There's some of the quirks are retained, though, so the quirky aiming and movement of GoldenEye forced on you by the N64 controller is gone, thank God. But if you are moving two directions instead of one, you're actually going to move faster diagonally than you
classic.
Do. It, right? Like the classic. You still have basically no reticle at all with your gun unless you choose to aim, which slows you up, which is fun.
It's kind of a mechanic ahead of its time, I feel like.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was really cool, right? So you got this hip-shooting thing where you can run around like an idiot and go crazy.
That's what I always did.
Or aim, you know, and try to get the headshots. Plus, you have body armor pickups, which restore, like, a restorable health bar, but there's no regenerating health or anything to fix your existing health. It is tons and tons of fun. It's absolutely free. You download the free Source engine, you download the free mod pack, and you go at it. They have added a number of achievements for you to work on, because Chivos are awesome. The other thing they've done is they've really taken... So it's not just the GoldenEye N64 textures redone for the Source engine. They really took a lot of time to make it look like the movie. And I spent a bunch of time... Like, I'm a huge James Bond fan. GoldenEye is my favorite James Bond movie with my favorite James Bond actor, Pierce Brosnan, because he's a cold killer. I love that. I love the way Pierce Brosnan plays Bond as this really ice cold guy.
Just, I feel like that's not a super popular opinion.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't care.
It's never bothered you. But
no, yeah. No. In this case, I love Pierce Brosnan, what he brings to the role. I think, you know, in the movie, the wonderful line, how can you do this? How can you be so cold? And he says, it's what keeps me alive. And it's, yes, perfect. And he really does bring this really cold, he's got the right amount of humor. And he also is the kind of guy who, you know, can be physical about things and get in fights and, you know, kill lots and lots of people. But he can also be kind of the believable ladies man, believable charming. But they did a wonderful job of bringing the textures and the environments to life. So they fixed, so it actually looks like things straight out of the movie. And I've spent a lot of time just walking around in a private server with zero bots and zero other people, just taking screenshots of wonderful little things, right, like in the bunker. In the bunker, you can see that the GoldenEye disc is inserted, the keys are turned, the satellite Petya has been selected, targeted at Severnaya, you're, you know, basically right on time to target. If you go into the little break room off to the side, you can see where Natalia has dropped her teacup. You can see that the vent is askew, where she's pretended like she's hiding while she's actually hiding in the closet. And little things like that I really love. And they have the higher fidelity version of the N64 soundtrack, which just brings me... I spent countless hours playing this. If you have the sound, the music will bring you right back. The levels are similar to what you remember. They're much more movie accurate. They look much better. You know, you can actually see in the bottling room where Trevelyan dies in the first movie and Bond sets the bombs. The tanks are actually properly multi-tiered tanks. So it really looks just bang on, spectacular movie. But there's also little Easter eggs you can find, like in the chemical weapons facility, there's the book Poisonous Green Gas for Dummies. Right, all kinds of wonderful little things like this. You can still find all the collectibles from that you would have been looking for in the first person, you know, the single player version of GoldenEye.
We should put some screenshots up.
Yeah, I've got like a gajillion on my Steam account, so I'll put a few of like the really spectacular bits. They're just like, yeah, this is way better than we could have gotten on the 64. So I've taken a lot of fun with the lot of fidelity with the platforms. I may, after this, I may see if JL write up an addendum and give him a good Yannis 6 minutes for to give it a try after we record the podcast. So stay tuned for a little bit from him. Yeah. Typing up in a couple of sentences what he thought for somebody who's maybe less of an obsessive fan of the movie.
Perhaps.
Anyway, but yeah, so that's my game. So this week we're being positive, giving you some game recommendations. Huge recommendation to GoldenEye Source. It is fun. If you're looking for a kind of a twitchy multiplayer shooter, this is right up your alley. It's kind of an anti-Arma in a good way, but not always. And I think you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it doubly so if you spent a lot of time playing on the original N64. It's a good nostalgia trip. But also a game that, you know, with updates to graphics and, you know, movement, it's aged really well. It's still, like, super fun, twitchy, whether you're, you know, getting your butt kicked by the devs or, you know, playing with bots who are, as always, a bit too dumb for their own good.
Yeah. I suppose I've got one for you, too, from a very different genre, that of war games, as you, you know, are probably very unsurprised to hear me say.
Shock.
For you today, I have Ajod's Civil War 2. Or AJOD, however they style themselves. It's, of course, a game in their Age engine, the only thing they ever build anything in. Like all games with said engine, it is a WeGo turn-based game. So, you know, you prepare your orders for a two-week period of time, and then they're executed simultaneously. That's about 115 turns for the whole war from April of 1862 to January of 1860... April of 1861, rather, to January of 1866. There's great scenario design. There's a good set of events that you take and kind of take you through a historical path while still leaving you enough room with the mechanics to do things ahistorically, which is, I think, the most fun thing to do in war games. The map design is great. The whole, like, graphical design is kind of old-school war game in that, you know, not super high fidelity sort of style, but...
It's not horrible.
No, it's like, it's almost painterly.
It's got a nice style to it.
Like a map with like a kind of a hand, not quite a hand-drawn look, but like maybe a hand-painted look. If somebody were like, picture, you know, a kitschy kind of folk map of America that hangs in your grandmother's kitchen.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the style of the background you've got going on.
Should say that the sprites aren't, you know, horrible.
Little like hand-inked cards of a, like, well, picture like a, well, again, picture the counters you might push around on a map table.
Yeah. Yes, like, but like nice
in a ones. Little, in a little base with a, like a card with the general's portrait painted on it.
Yeah, like a hand-colored patriot portrait or a linotype.
Kind of. So it's more or less aesthetically pleasing.
And it has an old-timey feel.
It has a great sense of place, which I've put in my notes with 4 exclamation marks because that's one of the most important qualities for a war game.
You really need to feel like you're a Union or a Confederate commander. Jay is a Union blue guy.
Well, I also played a Confederate game, but is it sitting in my chair in front of it? I could picture myself as Winfield Scott in this situation, maybe a little bit less old and, you know, immobile.
You're also less curmudgeonly than Winfield Scott.
That's true, by quite a margin.
Not saying much. I think I aspire one day to be as curmudgeonly as Winfield Scott.
Yeah. So, rather than take you like through a very detailed picture, I'm just going to give you some strategy notes for the Union and the Confederacy. I think the biggest note I can give you is, you know, play against a slightly harder AI if you want to do about historically well. The default settings are interesting, but I think my wins in 1862, late 1862, as both the Union and the Confederacy were more based on the fact that I was playing against the default settings as opposed to bumping it up one or two for, you know, being an experienced wargamer. So for the Union, you want to hide in your trenches. You have this lovely defensive work set up in front of Washington, and you have a manpower advantage and more artillery, all of which are, you know, very conducive to letting the Confederates batter themselves against your entrenched positions. And they can't really afford to do that, and they'll have to if they want to win.
Right.
So you want to do that, and you want to wait for manpower and recruiting to tell. You want to not bother with too much blockading, because that's kind of a red herring, I guess. You don't want to run that down too much, because that's factory capacity and artillery you could be putting at the Confederates, pointing toward the Confederates, and blowing them off.
This is very much a land war, and you should fight the wars of land war.
Exactly,
continental power.
I'm not against the idea of strangling the Confederacy by sea, but that shouldn't be your primary concern, as it was for too long for the Union.
It's also bloody slow.
Yes. I mean, it's the Confederacy is not that much of an industrial power. You don't need to worry that much about about strangling it, because it's already kind of strangled by itself. Once you have the superiority, attack. That's the part that Union generals were very bad at.
McClellan is a moron.
So anyway, the
he's at 11.
Exactly. This game ended in 1862 with the the surrender of Richmond to a siege. The Union lost about 45,000 men. The Confederates lost 60,000 in the field and 130,000 taken prisoner at Richmond. So the historical Union did so much worse, I feel like, just because the war planning wasn't that great and the generals were just abysmal.
Right. And that's something the game does a really good job of simulating in a simple and easy to understand
fashion. Well, through the mechanic, through the general activation mechanic. So your general has a strategy rating from, I think, probably zero to, you know, six or seven. I've seen sixes and sevens on the Confederate side. And every turn, there's a dice roll done against this rating to determine whether your general is active. If your general is not active, he cannot attack. So you'll have someone like McClellan, say, with a strategy score of one, which means he spends a lot of time just kind of twiddling his thumbs.
Complaining about it, he doesn't have enough troops.
In a very passive, defensive, I need to retreat, they're coming at me, sort of stance. So there's that. The Confederate campaign was kind of the opposite. I wanted to aim to hold ground rather than advance in Virginia, but I wanted to push hard in the west, wait for the Union to, you know, panic when I'm, you know, marching on Indianapolis, and then I wanted to defeat them in the field. That's something the Confederates can do because their generals were so much better and the troops were, you know, kind of higher quality overall.
Yep.
So you want to win victories on the battlefield with a favorable exchange ratio. So surprisingly, the casualties in this game were much higher, despite the fact they both ended in about November of 1862. The Confederates lost 130,000 men, and the Union lost a massive 275,000 in the course of about a year and a half of fighting.
Not bad.
So that, of course, puts pressure on the Union, forces them to, you know, not do any blockading, which lets you sell your cotton abroad and, you know, make more cannon, which, again, you're kind of at a disadvantage for. You want to raise your troops locally, too, where possible, because the Western theater has enough in the way of manpower and manufacturing to build the men needed to fight in the Western theater. That's, you know, like, say, Tennessee through Kansas. And you don't have the infrastructure to move troops from Virginia or Georgia, say, out to Tennessee, while still supplying said armies in Tennessee. And that's no good.
Yep.
And you also want to strike Washington if you can. When the Union bails out, you want to march on it and you want to take it, because that's the only way you're really going to end the war successfully. The Union wasn't going to move its capital; that just was a political non-starter altogether. And the victories in the field aren't enough to win overall. I mean, the Union knows that the Union has an insurmountable advantage in material and will eventually win the war if
more people and stuff than you.
Exactly. So. You don't want to let them build up enough to do that. Anyway, that's about that. It's a very good game. I recommend it wholeheartedly. It's also fairly quick playing for a grand strategy game, which is an important point. I finished two games in about, I don't know, 30 or 40 hours of playtime, which is better than, say, Hearts of Iron, which I've still never finished a game.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really solid to get a win condition or a loss condition and, you know, be able to move on.
Yeah. Well, I think that about wraps it up for games, which brings us to our second short topic of the day, defense. Now, we've got a good one for you here that evolved from a work conversation. We were saying, well, if I'm not going to buy arms from the U.S. or Russia or equivalently but less good China, who should I buy from? And there are very few countries in the world who have a proper native defense industry.
I actually want to cut in here for a small thing we didn't stipulate at work, but this occurred to me later.
Mm-hmm.
We do want to stipulate for most of these things because, again, there are a few countries, as you said, who make their own stuff. And since most of them are Western that we're talking about, or Western adjacent-ish, right? The one thing we have to stipulate here is that while we're not buying directly from America, we also need America to not be pissed off at us. Exactly. And that, I think, is a stipulation we have to have because more than once... And also probably that America isn't competing in these contracts for some weird reason. But it's a thought experiment.
You don't want to find yourself in the Iran situation. Right. You've got a bunch of Tomcats and nobody to sell you parts.
Also, I think Sweden has a couple of times run into the fact that if...
They can't sell stuff to other people.
Right, because the American State Department says, oh no, we won't give you the things you need export clearance for all those parts that you would need to make that sale.
What if we say they're for us?
Right? So it's one of those things where we have to stipulate here that America is not going to be actively hostile to this procurement thing.
Hmm.
But again, it's a nice thought experiment to do that.
Anyway, so we wanted to pick from the minor manufacturers of the world, you know, your Israels and France's and Sweden's and South Korea's.
Yeah.
We wanted to pick two that we would buy from. Because you can't really do it with one. You
need, right. Again, for one, to sole source it, you really are picking from America or Russia.
Or maybe France, if you happen to like everything that's French.
Right, and if you're willing to like deal with some shortcomings. Like, again, you have to like buy the French. Yeah, the French. You have to deal with French high costs, the labor costs. And you also have to like basically be France.
Plus you have to learn French.
Right. And you have to deal with, like, you know, the French doctrine, which, admittedly, the French are nice at doctrine at having, you know, their own. And...
Yeah. No, it's pretty cool. It's just, I don't think it's, really, if we're saying you can pick one or two, your choice is probably France.
Right. Yeah, that's not a very interesting thing. If you say one that isn't those, America would be number one, Russia number two, China three, France four.
Yeah. Well, your French have, you know, aircraft carriers, which is a nice high-end capability. A modern multi-role fighter.
Yep.
A ground attack support, like all kinds of aerial support stuff, which is another rare capability to have natively, and you know your land army stuff. So, right.
So yeah, France is reasonably well rounded.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I'll go first. So for this, if I'm going to pick two minor powers, I'm going to hit France. Take France as one of them. Again, they're too big and they do too many things not to. Again, France will do basically everything. You know, that gives you the ability to make tankers and other kinds of big air support vehicles, which I'm a huge fan of. They have a lot of lighter vehicles that are actually really... They build a really nice recon... number of really nice recon vehicles.
The Pen-Aard Crab. We'll put a link in there.
Yeah, because I've written about that. Yeah, so it's very nice. Even I like this thing. But they've got a long history of really deployable things for colonial conflicts. And again, they really make all kind. They make wonderful Navy stuff, excellent frigates, excellent little corvettes. Again, some of which things would be good alternatives for the U.S. Navy instead of that stupid LCS thing.
If you want like a bigger frigate, the Fremm. There's an article on that too that we'll put in the link.
Yeah. But again, you know, part of the rules is we get two, and so while France would technically do it, that's not very interesting. And the one thing they really don't, and there's a couple areas they don't cover. One, they don't have a lot of cheap air, like, you know, the low end of the high-low spectrum. They also don't do armor very heavily. Leclerc tank is really the exception, but that's not in production at the moment, and did very poorly on the export market. I think that's mostly a case of timing.
If you maybe asked them to build more, they might.
But it'd be expensive. And, you know, because the French had the bad luck to, you know, be competing against the Leopard when the Germans are trying to offload tanks and were basically going to give them away.
That's pretty hard. Yeah.
And that's hard. Also, you know, the Abrams had, you know, combat performance in the Gulf that was very impressive. So the other country I was going to hit up was South Korea. South Korea actually makes, you know, a number of things in-house they don't get credit for. They make a wonderful tank, the K2 Black Panther, which is...
Check the links.
Check the links, which is basically a Leclerc on steroids. It is a little expensive, not horrible. But it is up there in cost. It is, it's very similar to Leclerc in terms of overall design capability. Very well protected. It's nice. I mean, again, it's one of the few Western tanks that has an autoloader. Very survivable, good ammo isolation overall. Not as good as the Abrams, but very good. I could be happy with them. South Koreans also make a nice APIFE, the K-21. Again, Lynx.
Yep.
And this is cool because they have a... albeit Korean-sized, but a compartment designed around nine men with stuff.
It's empty. That's a much bigger mechanized squad than most people.
Even if I give them that, you know, Koreans are a little smaller.
It's not, they're not that much smaller.
Yeah, no, it's not a huge issue. Yeah, right. Nine men is pretty nice, you know, with stuff. And then it also has missile launchers and a 40-millimeter gun. And unlike the CV-90-40, it actually has a reasonable reload system. So you have three eight-round shoots, right, for a triple feed system for the gun, and then the remaining 200-ish rounds are stored in a big carousel under the turret with an automatic feed system that pops them back up into the chutes as appropriate. So this will keep you in the fight quite longer, and 200-some-odd rounds of 40-millimeter, that's hefty.
Yeah.
And remember...
It's almost like Bradley levels.
Right? And, yeah, this is really good. And, again, it's the big 40. 40-millimeter APFS DS will beat any IFE you care to name. That, you know, exists today. You can beat up its armor. You can spray it at a tank and make its life unpleasant. It's also a really big HE round, where the fragmented stuff, I think, is actually... Like. And I think you actually, the 3P, what they call 3P ammo, programmable proximity fused warhead with a prefragmented casing. I think it's actually 40s when they actually make, they make them down to 30, but 40 is where they actually make sense. Yeah. 40, a 40 millimeter shell going kaplang, like, you know, an old flat round, that's actually feasible and formidable.
You will notice that that was like the smallest, you know, air bursting round frequently used.
Exactly. And there's a good reason for that. You know, often there's a reason in history where, you know, well, 30, there's not enough explosive and shell casing to give you oomph, even if you can make the fuse that small.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And then they make the K9 Thunder, which is a self-propelled howitzer, 155 millimeter. With,
not in the links yet.
Not links, but there's an article forthcoming on it because it's actually won quite a number of procurement contests against the German PZH 2000.
We're not going to edit the links. You'll just have to come back and read it later.
Yep. And in that case, the Korean one is very cheap because the Koreans are building lots of them. The Koreans actually have, I think, a planned order of something like 1,100 of the darn things.
Well, artillery is very important on the Korean Peninsula.
Yep.
I mean, you want a lot of around for counter-battery fire when one of the Kims invariably goes insane and orders the attack on South Korea.
They also make a reload, an automated resupply vehicle for the K9, the K10. And so they're one of the, I think, the only one to make a modern resupply vehicle with a howitzer. That's a really cool capability. The price is actually very reasonable. Prices are really foggy, which is why neither one of us actually, you know, knuckled down and done budgets yet.
Yeah.
Because prices, we can argue about them quite a lot. But in general,
that would make for a very boring podcast, though.
It really would. But in general, the K9 is like a little bit. It's not quite half as cheap as a Panzer, as the PZH 2000, but it's pretty close. So you can just about get the K9 and the K10 for the cost of the one Panzerhaubitze 2000.
Totally worth it.
Which is, yeah, totally worth it. Or, I mean, again, you can bait or two of the K9s, depending on how you work the math out.
But if you want the Alpha Strike as opposed to the Sustain.
Yeah, so, but all good options there. The one thing, of course, to note is that the Koreans have, especially noticeable in the K21, it is built for their war on the Korean Peninsula. Armor is 30 millimeter is against 30 by 165, the Russian stuff, because the North Koreans have BMP-2 equivalents and nothing better.
But if you're buying for a Western power, that's probably what you're going to be facing off against, too.
Right. Also, I do want to give the South Koreans props. The K-21, though it does this through some clever weight means, is in fact still amphibious. So you can still cross rivers. And again, a big part of that is saying, look, we're facing down, you know, basically BMP-2s and, you know, crappy license-built knockoffs or unlicensed knockoffs. We don't need, you know, we're not driving these things through downtown Fallujah getting shot at with Cornets and RPG-29s. We don't need a gajillion layers of, ceramic and multi-layer ERA. We can get away with this and we can still have what's basically a lost art in the West, which is amphibious capability.
Yeah.
And that actually goes really nicely, like kind of the South Korean heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And then also the other thing I want to bring up from South Korea that, again, doesn't get a lot of press, probably like some racial component or something, but is they make a number of, they actually have a significant air industry. They did the conversion for their AWACS. They bought AWACS from Boeing, and did a the conversion was done in South Korea. They have a license for the F-16 that they make. It's like a,
that's an F-16 license is a big a big win.
License F-16 production. They have a really excellent trainer in the TF-50, which probably a forthcoming article on that. It's like, really cool.
Have I mentioned that before? I may have mentioned that before.
I don't know. We'll check.
Yeah.
But if not, there'll be an article with coming out. It's a really nice light fighter trainer.
Maybe I'll write one for once.
But it's a nice light fighter slash trainer analog, a really nice little thing, like kind of like an Alpha Jet or the Hawk trainer, but, you know, modern.
Modern and I would say a little bit nicer.
Yeah. Oh, they're definitely nicer. They're a much more capable, like, attack fighter in the light attack role. And then, of course, the other thing that South Korea has in terms of on the sea, I'm not a big Navy guy. The French do have, as we said, aircraft carriers. I don't really care. They do make nuclear-powered submarines, though, and I love nuke boats. Love them, love them, love them, love them, love them. And the French make nuke boats. So that's your nuclear-powered attack covered. They make SSKs as well. But, I mean, so does everyone, their uncle. And then the South Koreans, of course, really the big thing from them, they make some nice little Corvette-type ships.
But also,
the best damn guided missile destroyer in the world, the King Sejong the Great class.
Which we have spilled many vowels.
Oh, yes, but I'm going to spill a few more on it because it's worth it. It's a licensed Arleigh Burke, but it's bigger.
I mean, which really tells, like, that one sentence really encapsulates everything about it.
Why would you want anything else? We're going to take an Arleigh Burke, but we're going to make it bigger. Why is it bigger? So we can put more missiles in it. And then the South Koreans basically have licenses or make missiles that can fill any role you'd want in the thing.
And they've built, like, what, six of the things?
Yeah, and they might be ordering more. Yeah,
one of the most formidable surface fleets in Asia, like counting the Chinese.
Right, yeah, and that ship's ballistic missile ready, right? They're really formidable ships. Yeah. They've got the modern rolling airframe missile for SeaWiz instead of Phalanx. They're just great.
Lovely all around.
Yeah, you know, it's just like, why wouldn't I tap that license? Yeah. You know, again, not a huge Navy guy, but I feel, again, in the finest traditions of Continental Powers, you do want a couple big surface ships. I mean, also, it's the kind of thing you'd park in a harbor or, you know, offshore somewhere and just zap incoming missiles. Yeah. It's great.
Which is why it really pains me to be not taking South Korea.
Right? Yeah, you're kind of stuck. Right?
Yeah.
They don't go as well with fit as well into like what Fish Breath likes, and Fish Breath has some strong preferences that, you know, make me chuckle. But
well, so I'm an air and a Navy guy.
Yep.
So unlike John, I'm not big on land stuff. So again, I've got to take France because again, France is basically your only non-America source for reliable aircraft carriers and helicopter carriers and like smaller carriers. If you wanted to, like, probably get them to make those for you too.
Yep. No, they did already. Remember the two ships that were going to sell Russia?
Well, those were
helicopters. That got embarked.
Yeah. I don't think they had catapults.
True, but you know.
But a ski jump on the end. Yeah. Call it a day.
Also, I want to point out
J-O
here.
J-O bottles.
The J-O bottles would be perfect. The French also make a pretty complete line of munitions.
Yes, that's also important.
Airdrop stuff. And again, for especially airdropped stuff, there's not a lot of places that you can get air-launched or airdropped munitions that aren't from America or Russia.
Right. So you've got that. Their Navy stuff is pretty great. At least in terms of aircraft carriers, I like the Frem a lot. See the article behind the links again.
Yeah, again. Their Corvettes are good.
We've written about a lot of this stuff.
We're
I don't think their Corvettes are quite to Visby standards though, and
that's true. Depending
that
on
does
your,
kind of give away
how
my
you define
game.
Corvette.
Kind of gives away my game for the second one, which is of course Sweden, because I can't resist the Gripen and everything else that Sweden makes. Actually, I don't think there's, well, maybe the Archer, and the weird tanks they used to do.
The
CV-90.
That was the one I was waiting for.
I'm not big on those either. But anyway, but those are, again, like not really headline capabilities. And I'm fine with just buying whatever the French decide to make for their land stuff.
VCBI.
Yeah.
Which there's no link for because I haven't heard about it yet. It's too light.
Yeah. it's not a John platform.
No.
So you've got that. I really like the Rafale Gripen mix because both of those either are or could be carrier-capable fighters. And in the post where I chose the Gripen as Luckberg's main aircraft, you'll see that I said, if I were buying a high-low, I would buy the Rafale and the Gripen.
Yep.
So you can quote me on that. It'll be in the links.
Yep.
So I've got my aircraft carriers, my nice frigates.
Mm-hmm.
I've got lovely coastal defense ships and diesel submarines out of, I guess, the French and the Swedish. I love the Visbys, and the French make a pretty good submarine. I mean,
they make some solid submarines.
They've been good at that for a long time.
They won the contract in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. To replace those, what the stupid Collins is.
Yeah, and actually that's an interesting thing we should probably write about some more, because the French the Japanese were long considered the front runners, and they really half-assed it, and the French, you know, pulled out the stops and really, you know, went to bat.
He always had proposals for you, Australia.
Exactly, and they came through and won the deal. Yeah, really.
You want the industrial support? We will give you the industrial support.
Exactly. Gotta love the French for that.
Is it transfers of the technology? We will transfer all of the technology.
Yep.
Never again will you be stuck with cast-off Collins classes.
Yeah, which were not all that good.
No. Anyway, that's really all I've got to say. I mean, John covered France pretty well.
Jay's on the record as like a known Gripen lover. In fact, wife is aware that it's his other wife, basically.
Yeah. I've covered the things I like about the Swedish defense industry before.
Though I want to add a couple more. Because you mentioned the CV-90, which I know it's not a procurement game thing, but that's mostly because you're allowed to buy Russian in the procurement games. It's a really interesting capability in the CV-90 because you can basically pick and choose what gun you want and a large number of other things about them. They're very accommodating on it. It's won a ton of export contracts. It's probably my pick overall for best IFE currently on the market in terms of cost. The Puma is technically more capable.
It's so much more expensive.
It is at least twice as expensive.
And again, when there is, as the saying goes, a quality all its own.
Right. And the CV-90, you get to pick your caliber. The electronics are almost as good. You get to pick how many dismounts you want, basically, because you can go as high as 8.
There should be a word for ground electronics similar to avionics.
Yeah, ground avionics. I don't know. Work on that, Jay.
We'll put it on the list.
The electronics are almost as good. The protection is functionally equivalent, because nobody cares about shooting you from the side with a 30. 30 millimeter dome, of course. Right, they're both can take, like, if you put the latest armor on them, both can take RPGs from the side, both can take 30 millimeter guns from the front, both will fall to a tank if it gets mad at them. Right, they're functionally equivalent. The Puma checks a lot more boxes. It has a lot more buzzwords built in it. Technically, the electronics are better, but as I've said before, the IFE's primary duty is to support the infantry. Carry and support infantry, not to fight on its own. Mm-hmm. Also, again, the Puma loses points for me because despite having a remote turret, it only carries 6 men in the back. I don't quite see why it's silly to me to go for the unmanned turret and all of the unproven issues with an unmanned turret and the expense and not load up with dismounts.
Yeah.
The CDN, on the other hand, can be had with anywhere from 6 to 8 dismounts, depending on how you configure it. I did talk about in a previous post about why I thought the CV90 ends up being a better choice, even though it's better on paper. Links. Also, you know, it's the one that I'm leaning towards for Australia in the track competition. I think they might go CV90 there just because it checks so many other boxes already.
Yeah.
But again, you have the choice 40 millimeter Bofors gun with kind of a goofy reloading system,
as we mentioned.
Also, the 30 millimeter autocannon or 35 millimeter autocannon are options. And then, you know, dismounts, plenty of room in the back. There's also a number of options for them in terms of there's a mortar version available with 120 millimeter automatically loaded mortars. There's a recon version available. There's an APC version available. The CV90 has an awful lot of good variants out there.
Who knows? That could come in handy if there's something they do that the French don't.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, I think the tracked IFE the French don't have.
So I guess we didn't want to, we kind of talked about how we don't just want to pick France. But we ended up both picking France because, again, they seem to take having a native defense industry very seriously, yeah, unlike basically everybody else in Europe.
Yep.
And that's nice. I mean, yeah, if you can't buy stuff from the Americans, you can more or less buy stuff from the French.
Yeah, and the French mostly make
it's like actually native build. There's not a ton of American electronics in it, so you can actually, you know, you can buy it from the French, and even if the Americans don't like you, if the French happen to, like for instance Russia, you can still, you know, order helicopter carriers.
Right. And actually for
helicopter carriers.
Yeah, yeah. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Now, for a long time, the Israelis bought and really liked French aircraft.
Mm-hmm. As the Mirages.
Yeah, they did very well with the Mirages. And then after the Six-Day War, the French got kind of pissy for no apparent reason. And the Americans stepped in to fill the gap. So, you know, it's interesting there. But definitely things you can do. But this is a fun exercise, I thought.
Yeah.
Kind of, even though, again, we both settled on France for one of them.
It was kind of an audible, actually. Our previous talk was a lot less interesting. We had an interesting discussion / argument about this at work and thought it would make good to bring you to the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was better that we didn't argue as much here. Yeah. We still don't argue much on the air.
I think the problem is we talk about things beforehand and then we finish the argument then.
Right. Yeah, we're both... Well, I mean, also, if we don't catch each other when, like, our pride is, we're usually pretty mature, level-headed folks.
Yeah. So most of the time,
right? Do you have to catch the pride up, and it's like, okay, record this now.
Hang on.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think also very predictable things for both of us, at least if you, you know, can read a little bit more than just the obvious headlines.
Yeah.
You know Jay likes the Navy. You know he adores Sweden, like Swedish stuff. Saab. He needs a Saab t-shirt.
I really do. Not a Saab, like, car t-shirt.
No, yeah, like the Saab program t-shirt. And then I actually really like a lot of the South Korean stuff.
Mm. As you might have noticed from the article series he's been at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And plus, I mean, the South Koreans are probably the last country in the world that still is actually thinking about a straight-up conventional brawl. Yeah.
Well, you have wasted, in fact, more than an hour this time.
Oh, God, have you ever.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you chose to spend with us, however ill-advised that might have been.
Yep, that's right. So, the Crossbox, of course, produced by myself, John, and my co-host, Jay, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manyword.press, of course, where you probably found this.
Yeah.
Our theme music, of course, is Royal Rumble by J-Man of rmusicbox.com.
Thank
you much, Jay. Other Jay.
Not me.
And is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. And then we don't have anybody to thank this time other than Performance Shooting for putting on another wonderful match.
Yes. As always, we're very glad for them that they're, close enough to drive to.
Right. And that they also are willing to do something that's,
two-gun match. I don't have to go buy a shotgun.
Exactly. Well, a competitive shotgun.
Well, I probably wouldn't buy a very competitive shotgun.
No, he'd buy like a lever-action Winchester 1897.
Nice.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah, so thanks, listeners. Take care and have a wonderful September. We'll see you in October, which will not be red.